Our next case, as Councilor getting ready, is A24-0553 in the matter of, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Marco Camel. Thank you. As all council are aware, counsel for the relator will have 15 minutes for the relator's argument in chief. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, counsel for the relator will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, counsel, just approach the microphone, adjust the bench up and down to your level, and just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Julia Nierengarten. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Marco Camel, relator. This court's obligation when reviewing a dentistry board's decision to suspend a dentist's license is to determine whether the agency has taken a hard look at the problems involved and whether it genuinely engaged in reasoned decision-making. If the agency's findings, conclusions, or decisions are unsupported by substantial evidence, they are arbitrary and capricious and should be reversed or modified. The record in this case does not demonstrate that the ALJ or the board took that hard look at the problems involved and genuinely engaged in reasoned decision making. The ALJ reached two conclusions in this case. First, that the board failed to prove by a preponderance of evidence that Dr. Camel breached the standard of care as to either of the subject patients. And second, that the board did show that Dr. Camel engaged in conduct unbecoming a dentist, i.e. demonstrated gross incompetence in the practice of dentistry as to both patients. In reaching these conclusions, the ALJ noted that neither of the committee's experts identified any specific instance where Dr. Camel violated the standard of care. Both of those experts concluded that he engaged in gross incompetence while treating both patients, however. These findings are in...
What about the testimony that was put in as to, I think it was the second patient, where your client was not waiting for the infections to heal before the doctor put in the new dental implants? I mean, that seems pretty basic, isn't it?
Well...
And I mean, am I right? There was testimony about that?
There was a medical record with commentary from a doctor who was not called to testify at the...
So this was the doctor from the U of M, right?
Correct. Okay. She's the one who indicated there was, that she believed there was infection in there and granulation tissue that she said she thought was from an earlier, that had been developing before the surgery, but she never was called to testify. She was never cross-examined on those opinions.
What about and again, I think this is the second patient. I think there was some evidence when her friend, was pushing her gums and pus was coming out. I mean, wouldn't that sort of support the conclusion that the implants were put in before the infection before the infection was drained?
Well, I think that would support a conclusion that there was likely infection at the time that that happened, but I don't know that that alone indicates that an infection existed at the time the implants were put in.
Would you agree or not agree that if the doctor was putting in new implants without waiting for it to heal or the infection to go away, that would be gross incompetence?
I think that probably would be considered a breach of the standard of care. So, okay. Yes, I would.
Fine. You know, it seems to me that the you know, what really sort of alarmed the board and the ALJ was the voicemail. So what are we to make of that?
Well, there was testimony that the voicemail was not proper, that he shouldn't have advised her in the way that he did. That ignores, however, that she didn't actually follow his instruction in the voicemail. You know, she decided, you know, it's hard to tell from the record, but...
But counsel, if she had, she might be dead. We're talking about sepsis, aren't we?
Well, the testimony at trial was that Dr. Kamel was maybe not as specific in what he meant when he left that voicemail. I believe what he meant when he left that voicemail was that he didn't believe that the University of Minnesota emergency department in particular was the appropriate place for her. And I believe the testimony was that that was based on previous experiences with that particular emergency department that had not communicated with him on other patients who may have been seen there. He thought that that was not an appropriate way to address issues that may be seen in the emergency department arising out of dental implant issues.
He didn't suggest she go to some other emergency department or make time for her to come in immediately, did he?
Correct. And that, I mean, the voicemail says what it says. He testified that he didn't intend to discourage her from going to any emergency department, that he intended to discourage her from going to that specific emergency department. But again, we have the voicemail and we can't change what the voicemail says.
Would not an alternative inference be that, you know, he was trying to cover up gross incompetence by not having another doctor look at what he had done? I mean, it seems to me that's what really was concerning to both the ALJ and the board. Now, why am I wrong?
Well, I think perhaps it's assuming that Dr. Kamel knew more than he did at the time. You know, he knew that she had been back in his office a couple of times with complaints of pain, that they had attempted to treat the pain by prescribing additional and different pain medications, that she was having a lot of trouble with that, and that at her last, I believe it was I can't remember if it was the day after or 2 days after when she had come back in for additional evaluation and pain treatment, that they said to her, you know, if you have continued pain that isn't being controlled by the prescriptions that we have given you, you need to go to the emergency department. I don't think that it is necessarily fair to assume that Dr. Kamel knew at that time that there was...
Counsel, though, isn't it pretty common for a person who has extreme dental pain that is not resolved by painkillers to have a very bad infection?
That's...
I mean, I'm not even a dentist, and I kind of know that.
That's a little beyond the scope of this record. You know, I can surmise as a layperson, but I don't want to surmise as...
Because unless you can turn down the heat of the infection, pain management isn't going to do any good.
Right.
Isn't it actually irrelevant whether she followed his instructions or not? I mean, the question is whether the voicemail and all of the actions that he took, you know, whether in fact that was gross incompetence, whether it fell below the standard of care or whether it was in fact conduct unbecoming the dental professional. I mean, whether she followed it or not isn't really what we're supposed to look at here. We're supposed to look at what he did or did not do.
You know, I believe that's the board's argument, that we're supposed to look at what he did or did not do. But this kind of raises the issue that is very fuzzy in this case, which is, or I guess in cases like this where they evaluate these things, which is there appears to be some sort of belief that there is a difference between how you demonstrate a breach of the standard of care or a violation of the standard of care and how you demonstrate gross incompetence. And in this case, one of the major issues with this decision is that the ALJ expressly concludes that the board did not establish a breach of the standard of care, but it did show gross incompetence. And when you read the case law defines gross incompetence as having grossly deviated from the minimal standards required of a professional or a dentist in this case. And the standard of care is defined as an accepted standard of care a dentist who is in a similar practice in a similar community would use or follow under similar circumstances. That's two ways of saying the same thing. You know, if we're talking about minimal standards required of a dentist and we're talking about accepted standards for a dentist who would that would use it or follow in similar circumstances, though a finding of no breach of the standard of care alongside a finding of, but, you know, we do think there was gross incompetence here, those two things are in conflict. They're not, they're incongruent with one another. And in making that decision, it sort of doesn't make sense that the board did not need to establish a failure to meet accepted standards of care, which is, as I said, the minimal standard required of a professional to show that Dr. Kamel demonstrated gross incompetence in his treatment of these patients. And an additional concerning thing is, or an additional reason that we argue this decision is arbitrary and capricious is because it fails to even substantially acknowledge the substantial amount of evidence that Dr. Kamel put into the record. There's no obvious, within the written report, there's no obvious comparison of these of this testimony. There's no credibility determinations as to his experts. I know the board argues that we should infer from this that the ALJ found Dr. Kamel's experts' testimony not credible. But where the standard is that the board and that the ALJ in its recommendation and then the board in its review of that recommendation needs to take a hard look at the evidence and engage with that evidence to determine whether substantial evidence demonstrates this gross incompetence, that failure to acknowledge more than, you know, in a couple of sentences out of 29 pages that there even was testimony by third-party experts on behalf of Dr. Kamel demonstrates a failure to engage in the appropriate review of this record in this case.
You know, is it a fair statement that at least one expert witness testified that the voicemail was inappropriate and a violation of the standard of care in the dental industry because the documented infection that was found can rapidly progress to very serious? So isn't that, I mean, I understand your argument saying about the other issues relating to the standard of care, but isn't that enough to say that the standard of care was violated and that it was grossly incompetent?
If you accept that the commentary in the medical records that was not subject to cross-examination was accurate and you disregard the entirety of the expert testimony on that issue
and
on Dr.
Kamel's what's
side.
Wrong with the ALJ doing both of those things?
The issue in this particular case is that I'm sorry, I don't know whether the ALJ was a he or she, so I apologize for the use of a pronoun, that the ALJ doesn't even acknowledge an engagement with that conflicting testimony. It's sort of the way that the report presents the testimony and discusses only or almost exclusively the board's evidence looks like it's a foregone conclusion when Dr. Kamel walks in the door to try to preserve his licensure under the law. And the rules don't really define how that's supposed to happen, but the case law tells us that they need to, I mean, this is somebody's livelihood. We need to engage in a hard look at these things. We need to engage meaningfully with this evidence. It can't be a foregone conclusion. The ALJ needs to listen to, consider, and provide, I don't want to say evidence, but that's the only word I can come up with right now, provide evidence that they've actually done that. And this report doesn't do that.
So you would want us to remand, reverse remand, so that the ALJ specifically reviewed your expert witness's testimony and explained why he or she did not find it credible?
To the extent you don't determine that this is reversible on the record as it exists, yes. So, as we've discussed, the record does not reflect this reasoned decision-making where the ALJ made contradictory findings that the committee failed to establish a violation of the standard of care but did establish gross incompetence by Dr. Kamel. It doesn't reflect that the ALJ and the board took a hard look at the problems involved, where the report hardly acknowledges that Dr. Kamel presented expert testimony, much less what that testimony was. And these deficiencies make this decision indefinitely suspending Dr. Kamel's dentistry license arbitrary and capricious, and we respectfully ask this court to reverse that suspension and reinstate Dr. Kamel's dentistry license. I've got about 30 seconds left. I am finished. If the court has no more questions, I will just let them go.
I don't think we do, but you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now we'll hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Michael McSherry, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. I have some prepared remarks, but I just wanted to follow up on a couple of counsel's arguments that were just touched on. The rule argument about the standard of care, I don't believe there was any determination that Dr. Kamel did not violate the standard of care in the board's final determinations, and I think that the confusion relates to repeated treatments falling below the standard, which is one of the two alternatives that can be proven to show a violation of the conduct on becoming a licensed dentist. Dr. Roszkowski was the one to testify about the best practice issue, which is to let the site heal before you return and put implants in. Judge Connolly, I believe that was what you were referencing. In your remark, Dr. Roszkowski was the one who spoke to the best practice in this case. Judge Wheelock, you were correct that patient two's failure to actually listen to Dr. Kamel and to come back to his office instead of seeking emergency care from a qualified provider, the outcome is not the important piece here. Dr. Kamel's conduct is. The board's position is that his conduct, both in failing to properly remediate the infection before placing the implants, but more importantly, his conduct in telling her not to seek emergency care from qualified providers, that's the gross incompetence.
So does every violation of the standard of care automatically result in a finding of gross incompetence?
Not every violation, Your Honor. It would be, you know, fact dependent, and we have ALJs who can look at that and determine whether or not gross incompetence is determined based on one violation of the standard of care or repeated violations. So with that, Your Honors, I'd like to return to the idea of, you know, what conduct actually predicated discipline in this case. For patient one, it was approximately 2 years of treatment comprising at least 12 dental implants, 7 implant failures, protracted pain and discomfort, all of which stemmed from Relator's global issues in treatment planning, execution, and complication management.
His global issues? You mean, as I recall, patient one had a lot of health issues. Would that be a fair statement?
Patient one, yeah. It was a complicated case with various health issues.
So are those the global issues? All of his health issues, are those the global issues? And therefore, because of his problems, all of these, you know, at some point, Dr. Kamel should have stopped with the dental implants because with this guy's unique medical history, this was a disaster. Is that sort of what you're getting at? Or what? I'm trying to find out, A, what's the global issues and what did he do unique to patient one that constituted gross incompetence?
So the global issues is that he encounters problems during the treatment and he just tries the same thing over and over and over again. And, Your Honor, I would liken it to somebody like filling a pothole, for instance. They go out into their driveway, they find a pothole there. They do a great job of filling that pothole. You know, they pour some asphalt, they color match it, they level it off. The next day they come out and they find the pothole again. They do the exact same thing, day after day after day, without ever being able to maybe step back and look at the issue and think about whether there's erosion, whether there's a sinkhole, whether there's something else that needs to be done in response. And that was what the expert testimony regarding Dr. Kamel's treatment of patient one was. He was casting about. He was not responding appropriately as a situation changed over time. Dentists need to be able to respond to situations in flux, and Dr. Kamel, frankly, wasn't able to do that for patient one. It was only after about 2 years that he finally revisited the circumstances to say, okay, maybe it's time to explore some other treatment options. And that's after 7 implant failures, after over 12 total implants, and it's a lot of pain and discomfort to the patient during this time, and that's documented in the records. Your Honor, I did want to briefly address the reliance on Schultz because I think it does inform what this definition of gross incompetence might mean. On page 2 of Relator's brief, Dr. Kamel cites Schultz for the following proposition, and I'm quoting here. Case law says, however, that internal, quote, gross incompetence, close quote, means that a licensee, quote, grossly deviated from the minimal standards required of a professional, closing both quotes. That's not what Schultz says. Relator's brief is instead referring to the court's characterization of the board's conclusion. And reading from 375 Northwest 2nd 509 at page 514, the board described 11 instances of erroneous and inadequate record keeping with respect to both diagnosis and treatment. It concluded that Schultz grossly deviated from the minimal standards required of a professional in maintaining adequate records. So Schultz doesn't stand for the proposition that Relator relies on. Moreover, Schultz is actually instructive because it shows that a determination of gross incompetence can arise from a record-keeping deficiency rather than a specific act of substandard treatment. So returning to the central issue with patient one, the board properly determined that Relator's treatment overall demonstrated his gross incompetence based on those global issues. We had record testimony. Expert testimony that Relator did not respond appropriately to failing implants, an expert's opinion that implant sites should be allowed to heal following implant failure, an expert's opinion that Relator failed to observe the standard by immediately replacing the implants, expert opinions that Relator was reactionary and failed to properly reassess and modify his treatment plan, and excessively high implant failure rates. These are all global failings. Relator could be proficient in the placement of an individual implant. It's like that pothole example. His failing is in, he's not coming back to the situation, reassessing and changing as needs change.
So what are we to make of the fact that the there doesn't seem to be any explicit credibility determinations about the expert testimony? Where do we go with that?
The ALJ and the board are the fact finders here. They're entitled to assign weight to testimony. The court owes substantial deference to those determinations. There are findings as to each of the experts. Even on contested issues, like the experts gave conflicting testimony about whether or not general dentists could receive the adequate level of training and experience required to place these complex zygomatic and pterygoid implants. The judge credited that testimony. More importantly, though, as a fact finder, you know, when a judge makes a determination of credibility as to certain experts and other experts give conflicting testimony, a judge isn't required to explicitly reject that testimony. If you have two conflicting opinions or two conflicting fact accounts, crediting one is implicitly an exclusion of the other. And we cited the Pechovnik case, 765 Northwest 2nd 94 for that proposition. That's a precedential Court of Appeals decision. Moreover, the real crux on the competing expert issue is it's Relator's characterizations of the committee's evidence. They say that, and I'm quoting, small amount of testimony supporting the ALJ's conclusion and recommendation. That's at their principal brief at page 24. But Dr. Kadamani and Dr. Roskowski gave extensive testimony. They identified care deficiencies. They adequately explained what should have been done in both of these cases. And so, you know, the ALJ and the board, in exercising their fact-finding role, just has to rely on a scintilla of evidence to reach their determination. There's a wide breadth of evidence in this case from the experts. And so there is no basis for reversal on an ALJ failing to make more detailed findings about experts that the ALJ implicitly rejected. Returning to patient two, the board found that Relator failed to remove all of the infection from patient two's mouth before placing implants. If your honors were to look at the board's report, I believe it's page 13 and 14, that includes some relevant determinations about, you know, the proper standard of care for these cases. Dr. Roskowski talked about the, you know, allowing a site to heal before you return and place an implant. That's applicable for both patient one and patient two. More importantly, though, I mean, there's the failure to remove the infection, but telling patient two not to seek emergency care for her postoperative infection and claiming that qualified providers were incompetent to handle her care, that's gross incompetence. There's record testimony about the risk of infection. It can be, you know, anything from substantial bodily impairment up to actual patient death. And this patient chose not to listen to Dr. Kamel, instead went to a qualified provider and received potentially life-saving treatment. The documentation issues in Dr. Upgard's treatment of patient two, it's well documented what she found. Dr. Kamel was not a subsequent provider for this patient, so he didn't get to go back into the patient's mouth and assess the state of the infection at that time. There are findings rejecting his credibility on this issue. Likewise, there are findings explaining the credibility determination as to what Dr. Kamel meant, what he failed to say, why he didn't say it, and Relator's arguments up on appeal are really an attempt to recast the evidence in a light more favorable to Relator. This court is an error-correcting court. There is no error present in the ALJ and the board making credibility determinations. Those are supported by the record. They are not arbitrary. They are not capricious. If your honors looked at the medical records for patient two, there's actually notes from Relator's staff talking about the likelihood that an emergency provider would likely look at the fact of pre-existing infection and blame it on Dr. Kamel. And I think that you know, goes to what Dr. Kamel really was saying on the voicemail. The words are, as Relator's counsel said, the words are what they are. They can't be changed. This put, there's testimony from patient two about the effect that it had on her. It made her unsure. It made her nervous. Luckily, though, she did go and seek emergency care. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on the discipline imposed in this case. It's unclear to me from Relator's principal brief whether the argument regarding arbitrary and capricious decision-making applies to the actual determinations of gross incompetence or to the discipline imposed. It might be both. This is a case with serious conduct, and the discipline imposed was not a revocation as it was characterized in the reply brief. It was an indefinite suspension with the ability to petition for reinstatement after 1 year. So it functions like a true one-year suspension if the relator goes through and does the petition requirements and the board makes a determination that he's able to return to practice. There were conditions placed on his ability to place these deeper zygomatic and pterygoid implants. That's a 5-year condition. So in conclusion, Your Honors, the board's order was supported by substantial documentary evidence and expert testimony. Its findings and conclusions were extensive and well-reasoned. This wasn't a case where the board approached the record and shrugged things off and just reached its determination without any consideration. The ALJ and the board looked at an extensive record and they made extensive findings and they reached conclusions supported by the law. Relator has failed to carry his burden on appeal to demonstrate any basis for reversal, and I respectfully ask that the court affirm. And I note, Your Honors, that I have just a minute and 45 seconds remaining. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have at this point.
Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. McSherry.
Thank you.
Ms. Nierengarten, you'll have the last word, please.
I'd just like to address a couple of things. First, I want to point out that crediting testimony at one point in a 29-page brief does not demonstrate that the ALJ actually engaged with the conflicting testimony of these experts. You know, we acknowledge in our briefing that the ALJ lists these experts as people who testified, and the ALJ sort of does a comparison of what the experts said on one particular point. But there was extensive testimony on you know, all of the relevant topics, and these, you know, I believe in our brief, I know I counted it when I wrote the brief, so that would be the more accurate number. I believe there are, you know, maybe three instances where where the ALJ specifically references testimony given by Dr. Kamel's experts out of a 29-page report recommending the suspension of his license. I also want to address this idea that accepted standards don't... I'm not entirely clear on what the argument is, but that accepted standards and standard of care are different, and that accepted standards is not applicable in this circumstance. I'm not entirely clear on what that argument is. But if all that's required to support a conclusion that Dr. Kamel was grossly incompetent was a general opinion from an expert that he was grossly incompetent, that deprives the licensee of any meaningful opportunity to rebut that opinion. It's practically unassailable because it's an undefined standard. If we don't tie it to something like the standard of care and we say, well, this accepted standard is something different and it's not a standard of care, then how do we know when we go in? What do we need to show the board in order to show that we were not grossly incompetent in our treatment of these patients? And where the report finds no standard of, does not find a standard of care violation, says there's no there's no repeated or ongoing substandard care here, but does find gross incompetent, that conclusion lacks substantial evidence in the record. We've briefed these issues. I'm happy to answer more questions from the court. To the extent you don't have any, I would just, again, repeat our request that you reverse and reinstate this license, or in the alternative, remand for a more complete set of findings.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted.
Thank you.
You're welcome.